Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Legendary British actor John Hurt is known for a well-worn face and a distinctive rich voice. He's appeared in more than 100 films, among them The Elephant Man, Hellboy, Love and Death on Long Island, and Harry Potter. Hurt is also a star of the theater. He made his London stage debut in 1962. He's currently appearing on stage in a production of Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape, presented by the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. The production moves to New York next week. John Hurt joins us in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So I had the privilege of seeing your performance on Tuesday night in this Beckett play. The thing that struck me so much was how long you're on stage performing before you ever speak a word. How long is it that that play goes on before you actually say something?
Before I say anything at all, I suppose it must be about a quarter of an hour.
And what's extraordinary is that you're not saying a word. There's no one else on stage. It's the barest of sets, really just a desk and a light. And yet you convey so much information and so much emotion. Is that hard to do?
Well, I don't. It's difficult for me to say whether it's hard to do. It's the whole business of acting. I mean, it always intrigues people. They're always saying, "How do you do it?" It seems to be the essence of most questions about it. The difficulty of answering it is, of course, I mean, if you are an actor, you know. I mean, that's what we do. So therefore, we don't put it into categories of being hard or easy or whatever. That is actually what we do, in the same way that a doctor gets on with diagnosing a patient. You know, it's.
And yet, quite a tie, I thought, to the audience. The audience was totally quiet during this 15 minutes where
they were
you are.
Wonderful.
Yes. And I went with a producer from the Diane Rehm Show, Nancy Robertson. Afterwards, she said that it was kind of, this is not meant to be insulting. It's meant to be a compliment. But she said it was kind of like watching a mime perform, in that it was so physical, what you were doing.
Well, the beginning of the play is very much so. That's as written by Samuel Beckett. It's his way of setting up the character and the situation and what he wishes to talk about.
Is it sort of a relief once you have a role of a line of dialogue to say, though?
No, not at all. No, there's acting and reacting, you know. And I think very often the listening and thinking is as instructive and as interesting to do as it is instructive.
You say this is something actors just know how to do. Did you instantly feel that way the first time you were on a stage?
The first time I was on a stage, I was nine. On a stage was when I was 9 years old doing a school play. All I can remember from that, apart from the fact that my knees were knocking before it started, but as soon as I started, that all sort of disappeared, and I felt absolutely infused with the understanding that I was in the right place.
You know, I've traveled a lot as a reporter, have for many years, and I find that when I walk into a newsroom, any place in the country, whether I know anyone there or not, I sort of feel like, yeah, this is where I belong. And I wonder, that sounds like how you feel, isn't
it? Well, I think it is. You know, you find your niche, in a sense, isn't it? You find, if you're lucky, that is.
Yes, it's very fortunate.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I think one should, that's the first mantra you should have when you get out of bed in the morning, is I'm extremely lucky to be doing what I want to do and have been allowed to do so all through my life.
Now, you must have felt extremely fortunate or happy this morning when you rolled out of bed, because you have really an extraordinarily positive review in the Washington Post of this play. It refers to the miracle of superlative acting.
Please. I know. My wife read it out to me this morning at breakfast, and rather quietly, sotto voce, so that nobody else could hear for fear of, I don't know. There's a line in the play which is when he says, last fancies, and then he says, keep 'em under. So that's what I'm going to have to do with this review. Keep it under.
Now, do you usually read your reviews?
I sometimes do and sometimes don't. I don't think I've ever read all of them. You know, when you get all the, particularly in England, where you've got so many nationals. But I think, generally speaking, I tend to read them, yeah.
Do you get, not that you've gotten many negative reviews, but do you ever get mad at reviews?
Well, my best story about a review, I think, was many, many years ago I did a play called Little Malcolm and His Struggle Against the Eunuchs, which Michael Codron put on, and it was really somewhat avant-garde, and it was way, way ahead of its time, in a sense. But it got, generally speaking, terrific reviews, but there was one review from the Daily Express, I remember, which was pretty negative. And by this time, this is the days when you used to go and get the newspapers at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, because they didn't go to bed so early, and the newspapers, I mean, and so they printed very late, so they'd be out in the morning newspaper. And we were having the first night party on stage, which those days you could do, you know, there were no fire things or this, that, and the other. Having a grand old party, everybody was fairly drunk, and. Then the papers came in, and I read them, and then I read this one, and I said, somebody said, get me a bit of paper. So I got a bit of paper, and I wrote out, forget his name now, but a dear, whoever it was, whoops, WHOOOPS, yours sincerely, John Ho, and stupidly sent it off. Never write to a writer, because I heard nothing, but 3 weeks later, I got a letter back saying, thank you for your short but tedious letter. Yours sincerely, Peter Lewis, it was. Yeah, so I had to write a letter back saying, you win, Mr. Lewis. Okay.
You know, I sent out a note on Twitter this morning saying that we were going to have you on the air and interviewing you and asking what clips people would like to hear from your long career. And the answer that came back most often was one of your most recent performances, which was in Harry Potter. We have a clip from Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, out part two, out just this year, in which you're playing Mr. Ollivander, who is the wand maker of Britain. And here we have a scene with Daniel Radcliffe, the star of Harry Potter. Let's hear it.
Would you mind identifying this wand? We need to know if it's safe to use.
Walnut. Dragon heartstring. 12¾ inches. Unyielding. This belonged to Bellatrix Lestrange. Treated carefully.
And this?
Hawthorn. And unicorn hair. 10 inches. Reasonably pliant. This was the wand of Draco Malfoy.
Was? Is it not still?
Well, perhaps not, if you won it from him. I sense his allegiance has changed.
You talk about wands as if they have feelings. Can think.
The wand chooses the wizard, Mr. Potter. That much has always been clear to those of us who have studied wand law.
Who have studied wand law. Not a line an actor often gets to deliver.
No.
Was the Harry Potter film fun to do?
Well, it was, yes. I mean, I played Ollivander, which, as you heard, which has an appearance in the first one and has appeared a very small appearance in the penultimate one and the ultimate one, which is the scene that we've just been listening to. So really my connection with Harry Potter, my connection physically with the whole business of making it was very, very short. I did the first scene in the first one was, I think, probably a 5-6 minute scene where we set up and sold the wand to him and so on and so forth. I think we did it in 2 days. And then 11 years later, I do another 5 days for the penultimate and the last one, by which time, of course, they've all grown up. So it was like being in a completely different film, which, of course, it was a completely different film as well.
And this is quite an eccentric character you were playing. So how do you take the words on a page and develop your concept of the character you're going to convey?
I don't think there's an answer to that, but you're quite right. What one does do is, I'm a huge believer in the writing, and that is the springboard from which you trigger your imagination. How your imagination, one's imagination works, I'm terribly sorry, but I can't tell you.
And you have done such a wide range of roles, from a play by Samuel Beckett to the Harry Potter movies. Are there roles that you just won't do, that you've turned down and said, no, this is...
Well, there are roles that I don't. I try to mark everything like a sort of dreadful old examiner. And I don't like to do anything that I mark under 50%.
We're going to take just a very short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with the British actor John Hurt. And we'll take some of your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. That was John Hurt performing as Merrick in the movie The Elephant Man. He's trying to leave a train station in the scene, being pursued by children and men who are frightened by his appearance. What an appearance you had in the movie The Elephant Man. How was that look achieved?
Well, therein lies a very long story, but I can try and make it as short as possible. It was originally going to be made by David Lynch, the wonderful director who directed it, for whom I have nothing but the ultimate praise. But at that time, he was allowed to do it because he'd made Eraserhead and he'd made a rather terrifying little baby, which worked brilliantly in Eraserhead. But unfortunately, when he did the makeup for the Elephant Man, it literally was a mask, and it was unusable. I couldn't move anything. And we all had to think again. And then Chris Tucker came in, who was a wonderful makeup man, and we devised in his little studio in the Old Kent Road in London, with John Merrick's cast of his head in front of us, which we got from the museum, the John Merrick Museum, which very interesting because it had little hairs growing out of the cast. Very strange. Never mind, that's en passant. And we spent 6 weeks doing something which normally Chris said he would take 6 months to do. And we built it up, and it was 22 different pieces of prosthetic makeup melting away to nothing. And it took 7 hours to apply.
7 hours to apply. Mm. So how is that even possible to spend 7 hours in makeup even before you've done anything?
It wasn't possible, of course. I mean, there's no way that you could do. I mean, that's a day's work before you start. So we had to devise a new way of doing it. So we did the makeups every other day. And in the day in between, the crew had off, so they loved it. and with Freddie Francis, who was lighting it, and David Lynch and myself and the sound man, we just rehearsed in civvies, the next day's work for about 2 or 3 hours. And that's how it worked. But my day would last from, I'd get into the studios at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd be finished by noon, and then...
Finished with the makeup by noon.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then we'd shoot from noon through till 10:30 at night with a running buffet for those who could eat. I couldn't eat, of course, because I got the gums and everything else in. Yeah. it was a heck of a day. But I did think at the beginning, because the very first makeup took 12 hours, because I thought they'd found a way of making me not enjoy filming. But oddly enough, with a fantastic crew, terrific director, and, you know, with the film, there is at least light at the end of the tunnel. It's not like signing up for 7 years for a television. If that had been the case, I think I would have committed suicide.
Well, let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners ask their questions or make their comments. We'll go to Andrew. He's calling us from Cleveland. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Mr. Hurt. It's an extreme pleasure to talk to you. My question, one of my most endearing moments in your career, oddly enough, was when I was surprised to see you pop up in Spaceballs, the Mel Brooks film. Aping your iconic scene in the movie Aliens. And I was wondering, was that a lengthy courtship process, or was that something that you just left the chance to do?
What, to do Spaceballs, you mean? Or to do Alien originally? To do Spaceballs? Well, that was my dear friend Mel Brooks, who has a way of being able to get me to go over to Hollywood to do something for absolutely nothing. And then he brags in front of the crew, saying that this guy's made me a lot of money. John's made me, and of course, because he was the executive producer of The Elephant Man, and a lot of people don't realize that it was made.
Oh, wow.
It was the first film to be made by Brooks Films, and for obvious reasons, he kept his name off the bills, you know. So
for obvious reasons, because
because he's known for comedy, which is not exactly what The Elephant Man was about. So he called me over. The first one he called me over for was History of the World Part One, where I played Jesus Christ for it. Yes, and then he got me over for that one for absolutely nothing. And then when I got there, I realized that it was about a $6 million scene that he had every right to pay me properly, but he doesn't like doing that.
So that was in Spaceballs. Now that was really spoofing the role you had in Alien. Is that the role in Alien is such the moment in Alien has become such an iconic movie moment. To describe it to our listeners, that maybe some of them have not seen Alien.
Well, it's very difficult to describe, isn't it? Really, I mean, it's an extraordinary kind of a birth, with the it's alien that has incubated itself inside of me, and this is all made before CGI, so it's
CGI being computer generated.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what CGI is now. It's old fishes like me that don't know what CGI means. So it eventually bursts out of my chest, but of course that had to be done as it were, for real, because we didn't have computer-generated doodly-doo-doos. So in the cut from one side of me to the other side of the table, when I was rolling on the table in excruciating agony, they put my body in a hole in the table. I'm bent absolutely like a right angle, and they build another body along on the table. But that's all happens in the cut, so it's completely seamless. And then you've got one props man underneath it, pushing. I can remember when they were trying it out, they're pushing it through, saying, "Hey, is it coming through yet, Eric?" And Eric says, "No, I can't see it yet, Alf." I was like, "Well, give it another shove." "All right." Any good? No, it went on like this. Anyway, eventually they got it worked out. But that's how it was done. It was on the end of a stick.
And this is while the actors, you're performing as though you're in anguish, and the other actors are looking astonished at this alien being born out of your stomach.
Well, that was. I mean, there was a kind of myth that that the cast didn't know what was going to happen. Well, of course they knew what was going to happen. They've got a script, you know. But they didn't know how it was going to happen. And when it came through, there were all round the wound where it appeared, there were lots of little caps which exploded. So the blood just flew all over the place. That they didn't know, but they should have guessed, because Ridley had about five cameras on it.
We'd like to maybe try another clip from a movie. You received a lot of acclaim for the 1978 film Midnight Express. You won a Golden Globe. You were nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. This is a movie in which an American tourist, a young man, has been caught by Turkish customs officials trying to smuggle hashish out of the country. He gets a devastating 30-year sentence, and you are someone he meets in prison. Let's listen.
Well, there's no straight lawyers in Turkey. All bent. Bent as hairpins. Occupational necessity. They have special classes in corruption at night school. If you get suspected of honesty, then you get disbarred. I knew a lawyer fellow once. Got that Frenchman off. La Roche. Big smuggler. 100 kilos. He put enough bread in enough pockets. Got bail. Vanished.
His name?
Who?
The lawyer.
Lawyer?
Who got the Frenchman off?
Yes. Yes, what's his name? I don't know anything else about him. Yes. Best thing to do is to get your ass out of here. That's where you can.
Yeah, but how?
Catch the Midnight Express.
But what's that?
It's not a train. It's a prison word for escape.
That was John Hurt performing in Midnight Express. You know, these clips really let us focus on the remarkable sound of your voice, which is one of your most distinctive features. I was reading a review in The Guardian, or an interview you had done with The Guardian last night. I was reading it last night. You didn't do the interview last night. And it described your voice as, quote, nicotine sieved through dirty, moonlit gravel.
Thank you very much.
Is it just your natural voice? Have you cultivated it over the years to become such a distinctive instrument?
No, I don't think so. I do believe in, I mean, I think that the voice is a major, major part of an actor's equipment. I think you can create atmospheres with it. It's hugely important, really. But then, you know, there are other things where, like you saw the play the other night, you know, I can use a very high register, like spool. and so on, you know. It's there to be used. It's there to be played with. It's there, and it's important. It's a musical instrument in a sense. Yeah.
You use your body as an instrument as well, and I noticed in the play that you're performing in now, your physical posture is so different in the play than when you come out to take bows at the end. You seem like a very different character at that point. And there's one point, even though you are a man of a certain number of years, there's one point where in the play where you are slipping on a banana peel, and you manage, I believe, to do a full set of splits on stage, it looked like.
I don't know, is it splits? I have no idea. I know that it's, I try to hit the banana skin anyway. That's probably the most difficult technical thing in the whole thing, because I never know whether I can dare to sneak a look down on the ground, or whether the audience will see me doing that. Or, because you imagine that the audience will see you doing that, but probably they wouldn't. So, but you have to sort of gauge it and guess where that banana skin is exactly.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's take another caller. We'll go to Brian. He's calling us from New Philadelphia, Ohio. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. The question is, he played such a small role in the Harry Potter movies, but went 11 years between playing that character. You know, he said that most people ask, how do you do it? But how do you do it? How did you get 11 years between playing such a minor character and get yourself back into that character's head and play that character again the same way after 11 years?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, interesting question. I hadn't thought about it. I must admit, it didn't seem to me to be an issue. You know, I remembered him clearly. I remembered Ollivander clearly enough. He was in very different circumstances, of course, in the later films. He'd been tortured and so on and so forth. It's strange. I suppose the only thing I can tell you really is that it doesn't leave you. Once you've visited somewhere, it doesn't leave you. And it's rather like going to a place, I imagine. You know, once you've visited Prague, you're not going to forget it.
Well, interesting question, Brian. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to G-Day, calling us from Fort Belvoir, Virginia. G-Day, thank you for holding on.
Thank you for taking my call. I saw Mr. Hurd for the very first time in a little-known movie, An Osterman Weekend.
Ah.
And it impressed on me that I was looking at that very thin line somewhere between genius and madness, and I wonder if it was kind of...
Well, what am I to say to that? What am I to say to that? All I can say, The Osterman Weekend, I rather enjoyed that. That was Sam Peckinpah's last film. And he was a difficult old cuss. But once you'd made him laugh, I couldn't put a foot wrong. So we enjoyed making the film then. I don't know. Madness, I'll go with that. I'll go with that. Genius, that's up to you.
You know, I wonder, some of your movies have been huge hits. Some of your movies not reached such a wide audience. Are you sometimes surprised at which movies take off and which ones do not do quite as well?
Well, you can never be certain, that's all. I mean, you can be fairly sure to a degree whether a film is one that you're going to enjoy. But, of course, I mean, film, as we all know, and it's constantly talked about, so much can happen to it in the editing room that you can't be absolutely certain what it's going to turn out like in the end. I don't know. Yes, I'm sometimes surprised that things didn't do so well. I mean, I did one of my favourite films was Love and Death on Long Island, made by Richard Kwiatkowski, and I... with the reviews that we got, I thought it would be much, much more successful than it in fact was. I don't think it was terrifically well sold, and I don't think it was terrifically well dealt with when it came to being shown, distributed. So I think those things went against it, but it got amazing reviews. But the strange thing, of course, because it didn't do well enough, it didn't get a look in with any of the awards, which is really quite surprising.
Now, has the reverse happened where you've made a movie, you thought, wow, this is not that great a movie, and yet it's turned out to be a great hit? But perhaps that isn't something you want to identify.
I can't think of that. That I can't. Something really that sneaky. No, I mean, I've got a film opening here shortly, which is one that I did with the wonderful Gary Oldman, who's become a great friend now, called Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is the John le Carré adaptation from his book, which has enjoyed a massive success in England. And I hope... people are very, you know, people are always saying, will it be a success in America or not? My feeling is that even though it's British subject, it will the fact that it's such a good film will override it.
We're going to take another short break. John Hurt just mentioned that one of his favorite roles was in Love and Death on Long Island. And after a short break, we'll play you a clip from that movie. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by The Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday PJs for the entire family at pajamagram.com. By Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com. And by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, award-winning sports journalist John Feinstein tells us how he's gotten some of the most talented and temperamental athletes and coaches in the world to talk to him. His new book is called One-on-One, Behind the Scenes with the Greats of the Game. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And in this hour, we're having a conversation with the British actor John Hurt. He's performed in many movies. At the moment, he's also performing in a production by the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington, D.C. of Crap's Last Tape. And, you know, before the break, we were talking about some of his favorite roles, a role he mentioned in particular, Love and Death on Long Island. And let's listen just briefly to a clip from that movie.
Giles, did you ever see Tex-Mex?
Oh, I did indeed. More than once.
Really killed me when that one bombed.
Ah, yes, I'm afraid it suffered the same fate in Europe.
I really believed in that project. You know, it had a real message.
Yes, it was a great shame, really. You see, in Europe, we have a much stronger tradition of work with what you call a message. Well, that is, after all, why I've been persuaded to write my first screenplay. Yes, if Tex-Mex had been, say, German, about the plight of the exploited Gastarbeiters, it would have met with a far greater success.
They have Mexicans in Germany?
It probably would have made less money than Hot Pants. But then you see, in Europe, we're not necessarily interested in that kind of a success. Not when a film can change the way people think. And that, Ronnie, is why I write. It's also why you act. although you may not yet know it.
That was John Hurt in Love and Death on Long Island. Now, why is that one of your favorite roles?
Well, a brilliantly written script, I think. Beautifully directed, very simply. Taken from a Gilbert Adair novella. And just an extraordinary... excuse me. Extraordinary treatment of a subject. This, the whole idea of... It's about obsession, really, of course. It's not a gay movie or anything like that, but it happens to be, it is the object of his obsession is a boy that he's seen. But it doesn't mean to say that by any means that that's the way his life is going to go in the end. You have no idea, actually, how it goes. But it's a very, very cleverly, very witty, very, very, very amusing, and also rather touching, too. So that's, yeah.
You've had quite this long, interesting career. And I wonder, you've not written memoirs, is that right?
No, I haven't. No, I'm not old enough.
You're not old enough. At what age do you think you need to be before you write memoirs?
90. 90 before you're interesting.
And do you mind when people ask you about your personal life?
It depends who and how.
Well, let's say...
When, why, and what.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. You were once renowned as part of a kind of hard-drinking crowd in the theater. I gather that is no longer the case.
Well, I don't drink, but it's... I wasn't... No, it's not that I was part of a hard-drinking crowd. I think that all of us drank a lot. We all drank at that time, the 60s. It was a very different scene. I mean, also, we smoked and drank and so on. You do a television interview. A television interview, smoking a cigarette and having a drink, which is almost unthinkable of now. Well, it is unthinkable of now. In fact, if you were spotted now having a glass of wine with lunch, you'd be considered to be an alcoholic. It's nonsense, really. But admittedly, the 60s and perhaps the early 70s or late 70s even were somewhat more indulgent, you know, as we crawled away from the war and so on. And the pendulum was bound to swing. It always does. And it swung very much the other direction. And I don't know, it'll probably swing back again the other direction before we know where we are. So it's all these things are temporary.
And four marriages?
Yes, well, marriages are such personal things in a sense. I mean, that I can't possibly talk about them, but there's a very, very specific reason for each one.
And your wife...
I mean, they're not. What I mean is, it's just not a series of indulgences. There are very specific and definite reasons for each one.
And your wife is with you on this tour?
She certainly is. Yes. Yeah.
We've had many comments.
I'm very lucky that she is, because it was between me and the puppy we've just acquired. So the puppy was shifted off to where he first came from for 3 weeks. So I'm very fortunate to have her here.
We have gotten a lot of emails and callers who want to talk about your role as Caligula in the BBC series. Here's one from Cameron, who writes, "Thank you, Mr. Hurt, for helping me set the bar by which I have judged almost everything else since." And here's another email from Mark in Dallas, who says, "Can you discuss that project from the early years of your career and how playing such a madman impacted you as a performer?"
Well, what can I say? Often asked, am I a method actor? I'm not a method actor, depending what one means by method actor. I suppose I can appreciate a great deal of what Stanislavski had to say, indeed, but I don't think that's quite the same as the Strasbourgian idea of method acting and so on, and which is quite prevalent at the minute, you need somehow to be able to identify and have a real empathy for something. Well, very difficult to do with somebody like Caligula. I think Caligula has to be the product of your imagination. Again, comes from the script, which was brilliantly written by Mr. Pullman, and as an adaptation, of course, coming from Robert Graves as a book. But it was a very exciting time. Strangely enough, I nearly passed on it on the grounds that I thought, well, nobody could have been that. Nobody could have run the known world as crazy as that, you know? I don't believe it. It's hard to believe. And I sort of rather casually passed on it. But it was directed by a very good friend of mine called Herbert Wise. And he, because of the nature of the piece, was 12 episodes of an hour long, and they were all... half the people would never meet each other because it went through the Roman history, as it were. So he decided to have a pre-picture party so that everybody would meet, which is a brilliant idea, and for some reason he invited me along, and the atmosphere was so electric that I went up to him and said, I don't know whether you've recast or if there's still, is it any way that I could change my mind? And he said, why do you think I invited you? So there you are. That's a very nice compliment, I must admit, but it was but I'm very, very glad that he did, because It was a stunning time. It was a stunning time. Terrific cast, and I don't know. It's one of those times when all the elements came together, and I don't know how you can't plan for those things. They just, as we all know, you know, it doesn't matter what area of life you're in. I mean, I'm sure you feel the same, Susan. There are times when things all happen perfectly, and there are times when you think they should, you're working like a dog, but that nothing seems to go quite right, you know. But that was one of the times when everything happened perfectly.
Let's talk to Chris, calling us from Rochester, New York. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Miss Page. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Hurt, it's a real honor to speak with you, and I want to say very briefly that my three favorite films that you starred in, that you acted in no particular order, are Scandal, Owning Mahoney, and the one you talked about just briefly recently was Love and Death on Long Island. And having said that, Mr. Hurt, I wondered if you wanted to comment briefly on, or I'll be brief and you comment as long as you want, on the state of film in the year 2011. My opinion is that we've dumbed down film like we've dumbed down television, and some of the amazing roles that actors like yourself were getting in the 70s and 80s and even into the mid-90s seem to be fewer and far between, but that's my opinion. I'd like to hear your opinion, and I'll take your answer off air. Thank you, Mr. Hurt.
A very, very interesting thing to talk about. Actually, we could talk about that for a long time. But to do it as quickly as I can in the time that we have, I talked about pendulums before. Well, I think the pendulum is on the turn. It's beginning to swing the other way. I think that the public themselves have actually made it clear. I think that they are not appreciating being fed stuff that they're not particularly interested in seeing, and is not actually stimulating them in any way whatsoever. I say this also because, as I talked also earlier about Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy opening in this country very shortly in December. For me, that is a serious indication that the pendulum is swinging. As I say, in the UK, it was a huge, huge success. Here, it's got a more difficult run insofar as it is, of course, MI6, which is English and so on, and things English of that sort are notoriously difficult in America for obvious reasons, I suppose, really. But it's my feeling, and I hope that this is right, that the film itself is so good, and it is a proper film for grown-ups, that it will transcend the difficulties of that may be expected with the difference in nationality and so on. So in answer to your question, I hope that things are changing. It has been difficult. I agree with you. It has been really, really difficult to get anything off the ground that is something that you would want to go and see yourself, you know. But I do think the pendulum's on the turn, I hope.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We have a question submitted by an emailer saying, You co-starred with Richard Burton in 1984, Burton's final film. How was that experience, and was he aware of Burton's illness? But before you address the question, maybe we could just hear briefly a clip from 1984. Now, in this clip, you played Winston Smith, whose daily work is rewriting history. He rebels by falling in love, and this scene is his public confession after being tortured. Let's hear it.
I accuse myself of the following crimes. I have seduced party members of both sexes. I've been to the proletarian areas. I deliberately contracted syphilis in order to spread the disease to my wife and other party members. Together with other agents, I have counterfeited banknotes, wrecked industrial machinery, polluted the water supply, guided Eurasian rocket bombs to targets on Airstrip 1 by means of coded radio signals. I stand here a victim of the influence of Emmanuel Goldstein. Guilty on all counts. I'm glad I was caught. I was mentally deranged. Now I am cured. I ask only for you to accept my love of our leader. I ask only to be shot while my mind is still clean.
Amazing. A clip from 1984. So our emailer was asking what that movie was like, especially working with Richard Burton on his final film.
Well, I mean, one, it was a huge, a great excitement for me. I was going to say a thrill, but it's not really a thrill. A great excitement for me to do, play Winston Smith, who was a major figure in my life when I was about 16, when I first read the book, the George Orwell book. And then when I heard that Richard Burton was going to play O'Brien, it really was very, very exciting. Richard wasn't well at that time, it's true. He had big problems with his neck, and his mobility around his shoulders was extremely limited, and his memory was somewhat impaired too by that time, and he wasn't remembering words easily. But you know, fortunately, it's film, and when we got it, he was as magnificent as he ever was. And I can remember Michael Radford, the director, going to him and saying, "Richard, let me say this right from the beginning: we don't want the great famous." Richard voice, you know, and so he said, "Oh, thank God for that," and so he took it down to an absolute minimum. Absolutely, I mean, but it's still the most magnificent voice. I mean, Burton's voice was probably one of the greatest English-speaking voices of all time. You're talking about me, God. Burton had a fantastic voice. I mean, really, wonderful, wonderful voice. He could use the longest vowels and the shortest vowels. He could use every consonant there was. He was really remarkable, and it was a massive privilege to be able to work with him. Because not only that, of course, Richard Burton meant a lot to me because he was the first Hamlet I ever saw. I saw him play Hamlet when I was 14 years old, and so this was like working with a huge, huge hero.
Now, here's an emailer with a question that relates to the voice and the use of the voice. This is from Sang Mi, who writes us from Vienna, Virginia. She says, "My husband and I were able to attend Mr. Hurt's show last night and loved it. I was wondering if he could talk about how he used his voice when he was recording Young Crap's diary. The voice in the recording sounded so much younger and believable that it sounded like a recording from a long time ago. How did you manage that?"
Well, the truth of the matter is that it's almost... it's just over a third as old as it ought to be. I first played Crap in 1999 and recorded the tape for that production, and I've used the same tape all the way through. So that tape is now, 12 years old? Mind you, even then, I was using a register which was hopefully clearer than Crap, and also I make it very certain because Crap... is, as Beckett asks, is a rasping sort of noise. So it's a bit of age, and it's a bit of device.
And when you're in a play, as you are now, in a one-person play where you're the only person on stage, do you have rituals beforehand to bring you luck or to make you feel... comfortable? Do you have a routine that you do before you go on stage?
Yes. I'd always like to take a bit of the play and go through it. I go through it aloud so that I'm not I'm not surprised by its spontaneity when I get on stage, if you see what I mean. Yeah. Mm.
We've been such a privilege this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to interview the British actor John Hurt. Sir, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you a million.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and